WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
The news cycle keeps spinning, and we are along for the ride. We're going to break down all the week's top local stories in our weekly news recap. Stories like these.
The first snowflakes of the season are here.
The Illinois Supreme Court has ruled to dismiss charges against Jussie Smollett.
64-year-old Alexander Zestakiewicz appearing in front of a judge Monday morning.
Went to my face and said, "Are you Palestinian?" Which I said yes, and then she said, "F you, F Palestine."
Mayor Johnson is scrambling to come up with hundreds of millions of dollars in new revenue. Today he proposed new taxes and savings and took a shot at his critics.
Some individuals are having tantrums right now. It's time to grow up.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. Now, since I can't do it alone, we invited anchor and host for CW26, Brandon Pope, WTTW senior politics reporter Heather Sharone, and WBEZ criminal justice editor Patrick Smith to help me dig into the week's stories. I know we usually start the recap with a lot of serious political news, but to me, the big local story this week, it was definitely the weather. I asked them their thoughts on this season's first snow.
You know, I feel like every year, maybe every week, my opinions on winter weather change, but it's been it's been a while. I was honestly like really glad to see the snow coming down. I like winter. I don't like it to last very long, which I know it will, but like at the beginning, it's great.
Yeah.
The first 5 minutes of it's not great. Like when you first, you have to settle in a little bit, right?
Yes.
The wind was hitting, the snow was in my face, my beard getting snowy. But I'm with you. It's pretty. It's beautiful.
It's pretty to look at. When I don't have to go out in it, then I'm like, oh, this
that's
is nice.
The key. And you don't have to shovel it.
There's the key. Mm. There's the key. So which of you were desperately trying to clean up your car, you know, and trying to remember where that snow brush was? Or was it just me?
So if you don't know where your snow brush is, you need to think about living in Chicago. Because you should know about where that is at all times, because a freak snowstorm could happen at any point.
Yeah.
But yeah, I had to drive through it and it was deceptively like heavy.
Yeah.
And I think it caught the city perhaps a little bit off guard. Because,
well, we thought it wasn't going to accumulate. That's what we kept saying. We actually did a report the day before, like, oh, but it's not going to stick.
Right.
And woke up and that was wrong.
So I've got like a little ranch house, and like by the time you get all bundled up to go shovel, like just doing our sidewalk is like nothing. So I usually do like kind of my next
good neighbor.
Well, it's just sort of like I might as well if I'm going to bother to do this at all. But my neighbor beat me to it this time and shoveled. And I honestly felt a little bad. Like I missed my ritual of going out there and shoveling.
Yeah. Well, the snow is gone, but the drop in temperatures seems here to stay, Brandon. You ready?
I am ready. I'm a big guy. I love the cold. I need the cold. I need a little chill in the air, right?
Yeah.
I don't have a car, so I don't have the same struggles with like the shoveling and all that type of stuff. But the frigid temps, like I said, I was jarred to start.
Yeah.
I was not fully prepared. I was walking out here with no gloves, walking 40 minutes to work with no hat on, like a madman.
I was going
to
say, this like is a embarrassing madman. That
it
you're
is.
In
it is. I should know.
Yeah.
And for folks who don't know, Brandon is bald.
For those not seeing, yes, indeed. This is not a bald cat. This is real.
This is not a bald cat. All right. Okay, let's get into the meat of this week's news, Heather. Starting at Chicago City Hall. So after council members pushed back hard on a proposed property tax hike to close this massive city budget gap, Mayor Johnson and his team, they went back to the drawing board and they said, all right, we've got a different option for you. Let's maybe slash things in half. Give us a scoop.
That's right. So originally, Mayor Johnson proposed a $300 million property tax hike, which would have been the largest property tax hike since 2016 and the second largest in modern Chicago history. And the city council said no. So that sent,
to put it mildly,
that sent everything back to the drawing board. And there have been a bunch of meetings behind closed doors at City Hall. And so on Tuesday, the mayor said, you know what, we can get it. We can get this budget balanced with just $150 million in property tax hike. Yeah. But it's not clear to me that there are 26 members of the Chicago City Council who will vote to approve a property tax hike of truly any size. And that is problematic because the city needs to find somewhere in the neighborhood of $300 million to fill what's left of its massive, nearly $928 million budget gap. Mm-hmm. And really, the best way, the most effective way the city can raise revenue is to raise property taxes. But if the city council is saying, no, we're not going to do that, that means that they're going to have to raise likely a host of taxes and perhaps fees. So on the table is the garbage fee.
Yeah.
Right now, Chicagoans pay about $10 a month to get their garbage hauled away. That hasn't risen since 2016. Maybe that should go up. Maybe Chicagoans should have to pay a little bit more to lease computer programs. Like when you sign up for that Word subscription, the city gets a cut of those taxes. Now, that is a potential way to raise about $130 million, but that still leaves a big gap. So the question is can you sort of raise enough taxes to get to that $300 million? And is that acceptable to the city council members, or are they going to balk at that too? Mm-hmm. Because then it gets into a situation where you're sort of maybe opening yourself up to criticism that you're nickeling and diming Chicagoans. Yeah.
And the thing is, Pat, there just aren't that many levers for the mayor to pull when it comes to filling the budget gap. That's nearly $1 billion with a B dollars, right?
Yeah, I mean, you hear Heather lay it out there, and it does sound like nickel and diming, this idea. And frankly, if you're raising things like fees, that's regressive. And I'm not saying I want a big property tax hike. I have not crunched the numbers enough to say what's necessary or not necessary. But it sounds like nickel and diming to me, and I wonder, is that actually politically more viable? I mean, I'd ask both of you. You guys are better at this than I am. Like, politically, is that more palatable to people? It's just kind of easier to slide it by if it's a little bit here and a little bit there rather than one big bill that comes to homeowners.
Yeah, what do you think, Heather?
Yeah, well, I mean, nobody likes sort of seeing that big property tax spike happen twice a year. So if you own a home worth about $250,000, had property taxes gone up $300 million, you would have paid in the neighborhood of, about $20 more a month. Like, is that a huge deal in the long scheme of things? Probably not. Mm. So you're going to see that about cut in half if that $150 million property tax hike comes in. But the city is just one taxing agency. Mm. We pay property taxes to libraries, to schools, to all sorts of districts, like the Mosquito Abatement District, which is my personal favorite taxing district.
The Mosquito Abatement District.
So, and, you know, the way that taxes are structured in Illinois rely on property taxes. So you hear a lot about the mayor sort of talking about needing to sort of rejigger that and sort of raise taxes on the wealthiest Illinois residents. And the state's law just really does not allow that, which is why the mayor finds himself between a rock and a hard place. And we heard him becoming increasingly frustrated with what he finds himself
in. Yeah, speaking of, Brandon, he says, he accuses the alders of, quote, having tantrums. And he said, I think we heard it earlier, it's time to grow up. It just seems like he's got a lot of work to do to win support here.
Yeah, and that rhetoric is not going to help because the dynamics of Chicago city government are different than they were 20 years ago. 20 years ago, the mayor was the top dog and could talk like that, right? Yeah. Now, you have a bunch of aldermen who are not going to just sit back and take that, right?
You need them.
And he's also calling himself the collaborator in chief right now because he thinks he's responsible for bringing aldermen together and coming up with new solutions. And the reality is, no, they are rebuking this, man. And they're coming together out of, nah, we ain't doing that. We going to do our own thing. Aldermen were meeting over weekends, late nights, trying to get something workable. Frustrated, but seeing the need for them to take over here,
right?
That's the dynamic at play right now.
If you're
I'm curious. The aldermen who are rejecting property tax increases, and I don't mean to take the responsibility away from the mayor, but like, What is their solution? Because I've heard them talk about redundancies and efficiencies. Every politician every year says that. I'm sure there are inefficiencies and redundancies, but like every single year we're not gonna plug this hole with that.
Right.
And so what is their solution?
Well, and the mayor has said, I will not assign a budget that includes layoffs or furloughs of city employees, which means you can't cut services, which means, you know, there are really only three ways to sort of balance a budget. It's not rocket science. You can either raise revenue, so more taxes, cut services. The mayor says that's not an option. Or you can borrow. And the city can't borrow anymore because it is just hugely leveraged. Mm-hmm. Now, if I were a cynical person, and I strive very hard not to be a cynical person, the mayor's budget right now calls for $272 million to go in an advanced payment to the city's pension funds. So if you don't make that payment, essentially if the city continues to just pay the minimum on its pension credit cards, if you want to think about it that way, there's no need for significant tax hikes or anything. Mm-hmm. Now, is that penny wise and pound foolish? That's what the mayor would tell you. But we are less than 6 weeks away from the deadline to get this budget done. Mm-hmm. And sometimes in politics, it becomes the path of least resistance, becomes the most attractive. Will that happen? I have no idea. But it is very difficult to find hundreds of millions of dollars in new revenue or cuts on this compressed time frame at a moment where sort of everybody is, you know, really sort of at loggerheads.
And for a mayor who ran on labor and is all about labor rights, cutting workforce, that's a non-starter for him politically. So that's where the politics are meeting reality in a way. People don't like property tax increases. We've trained people not to like property tax increases, right?
And we know that now.
We put the big number out there. We don't really give the how much it would actually mean for your pocketbook right away, right? And so that's the reality of the playbook here. His politics, his chances for reelection, all this are banking on his progressive vision, his progressive backing. And if he's going to keep that kind of resume there, cutting labor is absolutely a non-starter for him.
So we're going to stick with Chicago news for just a bit. Heather, you published a story with ProPublica. It was looking at the lack of progress when it comes to the consent decree over the last 5.5 years. Now, that's the document that, of course, lays out mandatory reforms within the CPD. So tell us a bit about who you spoke with and what you found.
Well, I worked on this with Vernal Coleman and Jared Rutecki, who's also at WTTW with me. And we wanted to do sort of a deep dive into the consent decree, which has cost Chicago taxpayers hundreds of millions of dollars over the past 5.5 years, has been the subject of hundreds of meetings and have been the subject of hundreds more court hearings. But the city has only complied with 9% of the order in full. And unless we heard from reform advocates and people who are sort of keeping track of this, unless the city really takes a new approach to complying with these requirements, the city is on a path to be under this court order for the foreseeable future, decades. Mm-hmm. Now, this year alone, the mayor has set aside $194 million to comply with this agreement. So you want to talk needing $300 million? Well, that's $200 million of it right there. And what we found was that the police department has really failed to sort of even attempt to address the core of this agreement, which really requires the city to do three things. It's very complicated, but the long and the short of it is that it has to reorganize the police department to really institute community policing, which assigns specific officers to work consistently in the same part of the city with the people who live there to address public safety threats.
Right.
That does not exist today in the Chicago Police Department. The police department also has to conduct a study of where officers work and whether what they're doing is effectively addressing crime. The city now has a contract to conduct that study, but it hasn't even started yet. And of course, this agreement started back in 2019. And the third thing that it has to do is it has to figure out a way to identify officers who are the subject of multiple misconduct complaints or lawsuits and figure out what is going on. Do they need counseling? Do they need retraining? Do they need discipline? And to get them whatever that is. But right now, there's no unified system that flags officers who are the subject of multiple complaints. And we know that those officers are responsible for hundreds of millions of dollars right. in misconduct settlements. And we know that it's many of the same officers, as many as 200, are the subject of multiple lawsuits that have cost right. taxpayers millions of dollars.
Over 5.5 years, not much progress on some very important issues. Patrick, you and I have talked about this so many times, this consent decree. What's on your mind? What sticks out from the investigation?
Well, I mean, first of all, just what an impressive piece of work it was by Heather and her colleagues.
Thank you.
And as somebody who has covered the consent decree a lot, one thing that I've struggled with is how do you make people understand the scope of this? How do you make people understand the scope of failure and why this is important? And I think what Heather's story lays out is it's important to remember, like, this is not just a complex and lengthy legal document. What happened was after the police murder of Laquan McDonald, the city of Chicago agreed with the state of Illinois and with a federal investigation that, yeah, our police department is fundamentally broken and we need huge changes to how we police our communities. And they're just not making any changes. And the point of having a consent decree is that, yeah, politically, mayors and police superintendents say they like reform, they say they believe in change, and then they don't actually do it. And the point of a consent decree is that they're supposed to be forced to do it.
Yeah.
And that is not happening. And one thing that Heather gets into in her story is that there has been no real enforcement action by the monitor, who we are paying a lot of money to.
$20 million since 2019.
To oversee this consent decree. And there hasn't been enforcement activity by the two judges who have overseen this. And what I will be watching for is, are they going to actually step up and do anything about the city repeatedly and constantly failing to meet its legal requirements?
Yeah. Well, another story that broke yesterday, the Illinois Supreme Court overturned the conviction of actor Jussie Smollett. I did not have this story making a comeback on my 2024
bingo
card.
It's never going to die, Sasha.
The same day as the Matt Gaetz story, too.
Patrick, real quick, what's the deal here?
Yeah, so people might remember actor Jussie Smollett, who was on Empire, has a more famous sister. Maybe that was burning up in him. I don't know.
Yeah.
allegedly staged a fake hate crime against himself in Chicago. Ultimately, he was charged with disorderly conduct for allegedly lying to police about that. The Cook County prosecutors agreed to drop that case, and he paid some money. He did some community service. There was a lot of public outrage over that.
Mm-hmm.
A special prosecutor was appointed. They filed new felony charges. Smollett was convicted of felony disorderly conduct. Now, yesterday, the Illinois Supreme Court said essentially that was double jeopardy. I mean, that was Smollett's argument. They didn't use those words, but they said it violated due process. Basically, that original agreement that prosecutors made, that was a binding agreement. You can't just go after him again.
Mm-hmm.
And I know people were surprised by this. I will say one reason I wasn't surprised that this came out is State's Attorney Fox has been telling me they are going to overturn this and this is coming soon.
Oh, really?
And she was right.
Does this decision, Brandon, I mean, does it now reverse the doubts that were cast on Smollett over the last few years?
I mean, I think there's still so many questions unanswered.
He says he's innocent.
Right? He says he's innocent, but when you look at the case, you got to squint and you really got to look closely. It's hard to believe this is 5 years ago, right? It feels like it was just yesterday. They should put a plaque where that subway is. But
in Trump country.
Right, yeah, exactly. In Trump country, Streeterville. Yeah. But at the end of the day, it really, why this story really pierced the veils, because you got celebrity involved, you got scandal involved, you got politics involved. This reversal here, I'm curious to see what happens next for Jussie Smollett, the man.
Mm.
You know, seems like he's vindicated here a bit. Does he have a career after this? Does he go back into movie making?
I wonder
if Tyler Perry film?
I was just going to say that. If I'm an exec like a Tyler Perry, am I casting him in anything, or am I staying away because he seems like trouble?
Yeah.
Well, speaking of vindication, it's not just vindication, I think, for Smollett. It might be vindication for Kim Fox, Patrick.
That is certainly how she sees it. You know, I talked to her yesterday, and she sees this as, you know, this is vindication that we had the right, whether you agree with the deal we struck with Smollett or not, we had the right to strike that deal. It was within our purview and within prosecutorial discretion. And everything after that was a waste of time and an attempt to tar my name.
Yeah, let's hear her.
5 years later, millions of dollars later, an unseemly amount of media attention finds us where we were in March of 2019 with the exact same result. And so I knew in March 2019, the office did nothing wrong. And to be here 5 years later, I'm not surprised. I'm grateful that justice is finally served.
Anything else the Cook County State's Attorney had to say?
Well, I think one thing that's really interesting, you know, the special prosecutor, Dan Webb, he said that there were misstatements, misleading statements by Fox, that there were operational failures by her in her office. State Attorney Fox says that's not true, and or that basically he had this broad overreach in this investigation. And, I mean, one thing that she has spoken about quite eloquently quite often is how much attention that Brandon is talking about, how much attention was paid to this case. She's basically like, you guys, all you want to talk about is one black man who didn't go to jail, and we have all of these black people that I have helped get exonerated because they were wrongfully convicted. People don't want to talk nearly as much about that. I think she has a point.
Yeah. Well, from a hate crime hoax case to an alleged hate crime in suburban Downers Grove, a Darien, Illinois woman was arrested this week. This was after allegedly attacking a man and his pregnant wife while in line at Panera Bread. Mm. What happened, Patrick?
Yeah, this was a Palestinian man who was wearing a sweatshirt that said Palestine on the back. Alexandra Sostakiewicz was in this Panera, and she's caught on video kind of lunging at him. According to reporting, he was kind of trying to protect his pregnant wife from her. She, again, this part's not on video, but allegedly said, you know, F Palestine, and attacked him. We heard a little clip of him, I think, at the top of the show.
Yes.
She's now charged with she's facing hate crime charges and disturbing the peace, due back in court in December.
Surprise! We had one more guest stopping by for just a bit. John Seidel covers courts for the Chicago Sun-Times, and he came with updates from the federal corruption trial of former House Speaker Michael Madigan. Now, the big news this week was that former Alderman Danny Solis took the stand in the Madigan trial. The Fed said he is one of Chicago's, quote, most significant cooperators in the last several decades. So I asked John to remind us, who is Solis, and what's his role in the trial?
Sure. And I'd say that comment by prosecutors, I mean, that's saying something in a town like Chicago, right?
But yeah.
So, all right. So just to kind of set the scene with Danny Solis here a little bit. He was an alderman on the city council for more than 20 years. He represented the 25th Ward. Before that, he was an activist. He was involved in various community organizations with the Latino community. Richard M. Daley actually picked him to fill a vacancy on the city council back in 1996. Mm-hmm. So he was on the city council for a long time, and he became the chairman of the zoning committee, which is very influential and also key in the Madigan trial. But in around, let's say, well, 2014 or so, he caught the attention of the FBI, and the FBI began to tap his phone and surveil him, follow mm-hmm. him around. And eventually in June 2016, they had all these search warrants ready to go. They were going to search his home. They were going to raid City Hall, his City Hall offices, everything else. But they confronted him, and they convinced him to cooperate in what was then the early stages of the investigation that led to this whole trial.
Wow.
So Solis agreed to cooperate, and that's why the FBI did not descend on City Hall that day. Instead, they came to City Hall 2 years later when they raided the offices of Ed Burke, who's one of the politicians that Solis videotaped and video recorded. But he also recorded Madigan.
Mm-hmm.
And he continued that undercover work until January 2019. When his work was exposed by the Sun-Times, which also came up in the trial this week. And so now he's finally taken the stand. And this is actually, even though he testified as a defense witness in Burke's trial,
Yeah. This
is the first time he's been called as a prosecution witness. And the government didn't even ask him any questions in Burke's trial.
Really?
They did not even cross-examine him. So this is really the first time that we're having the government question him and walk him through his history, what he's done, and what happened with Mike Madigan.
What's he sharing so far?
You know, he was only on the stand for about an hour, less than an hour on Thursday, and there's no trial on Fridays. So far, he's really just talked about his own background and how things worked at City Hall and how he got to know Mike Madigan. That's all the jurors have heard from Danny Solis. But I should say that things got really electric before Danny Solis took the stand. You know, Madigan's trial really shifted yesterday. In a way, it feels like a brand new trial now. For 5 weeks, we've been hearing testimony about this ComEd bribery scheme. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's stuff we've heard before in another trial. Now they started introducing the jury to another part of the case in which Madigan was allegedly trying to use Solis to get business for Madigan's law firm. It's a completely different kind of allegation here, more akin to what happened with Burke. And so they put an FBI agent on the stand yesterday to kind of explain to the jurors what happened with Solis. And that's when just kind of like this really rapid fire testimony started coming at us about you know, Solis and Madigan being recorded by another government cooperator, a Chinatown developer back in 2014. And that started the wiretap. And we got these disclosures about Solis's sister.
Yeah, what, she was a campaign manager for Hillary Clinton at one
Danny
point.
Solis's sister was a campaign manager for Hillary Clinton's 2008 presidential campaign. Yes.
So what did we find out from her calls?
Well, that's the thing. First of all, we found out that they wiretapped her phone.
Oh my goodness.
That had never come out before, and that came out on cross-examination. The FBI had overheard Danny Solis and Patty Solis Doyle discussing a $100,000 payment that had been offered to Patty Solis Doyle by a hotel developer. This is all, this was the testimony from an FBI agent on the stand.
Yeah.
And based on that, the FBI secured permission to wiretap Patty Solis Doyle's phone in October 2014. I want to be clear that you know, she was never charged with anything. The agent testified that it was not fruitful. Mm-hmm. This was 10 years ago. But it's still notable, and you know, because of who she was, what she did, and who she might have been talking to.
Right. Heather, I know you were watching this section of the trial.
I mean, this was kind of a bombshell that we didn't even know existed out there, because the thing with federal investigations is that once the feds can prove to a judge they have probable cause to get up on somebody's phone, there's really no way of telling where it's going to lead. And I think that we all sort of took a deep breath knowing that this was, you know, sort of an avenue we didn't know that they had explored and could have been potentially explosive, even if it wasn't.
Yeah.
But I think it's important to note that, you know, not only did Danny Solis agree to serve as a government informant to avoid being charged with really a whole host of criminal activity, including taking bribes as chair of the zoning committee, which he has admitted to, but that he did so and recorded not just Michael Madigan, but Alderman Ed Burke, who is currently serving a 2-year prison sentence right now. And as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, but the feds were targeting Madigan and sort of stumbled across Burke's illicit doings with Danny Solis. And that is essentially why Ed Burke is in jail today.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, what's interesting is that there was a suggestion from the agent on the stand that, you know, initially Solis's cooperation had to do with a universe of individuals that had nothing to do with the case in front of the jury yesterday. So, and you're right, in the Burke trial, the same agent testified that they didn't start out with Burke either. So, yeah, they were,
my goodness.
You know, it's unclear.
Just a web of corruption here in the city.
And that's one of the most frustrating things about covering these cases, because federal agents, I don't know, maybe they call you up. They don't call me up and say, here's what we're trying to find out.
Got
and
John on
here's what
down.
We're doing.
Oh, boy. Well, while you're still here, John, I know earlier this week, jurors also saw this printed out email calling several of co-defendant Michael McLean's handwritten notes. They call them the magic list?
The magic list. Here's
what's so magic about it?
Not much, honestly.
It's a good name, though.
So it's a great name, and you got to know Michael McLean. So Michael McLean is Madigan's co-defendant, right? He's a former lawmaker turned lobbyist who had this really close relationship with Madigan, where it got to the point where people in Springfield understood if you were talking to Michael McLean, you were talking to Michael Madigan. But Michael McLean, like, he's just kind of a colorful character. And what all the magic list is, it's on a piece of stationery paper from the Talbot Hotel. And it's a list of
love the attention
of
to detail.
People, right? It's a list of names of people who are, you know, friendly with Madigan, like lobbyists and things like that. But, you know, McLean called it the magic list. But here's why it matters, is because Madigan's on trial for a racketeering enterprise. You know, he allegedly led this criminal enterprise designed to enrich himself and his allies. Well, you know, I think that list speaks to the broader enterprise, right? These are the people that they could go to who would help Madigan out, and that Madigan would then in turn help them out.
Yeah, Pat, I see the look on your face here. You've got a question about this so-called list.
Well, I'm very interested in the magic list. I'm interested in Solis, you know, coming back to the stand on Monday. Obviously, this is a long, complex trial. How important is this moment for prosecutors? Like, do they need him to really land with the jury? I mean, you've covered a lot of trials, in your opinion.
Yeah, I think they do. And you're right. And you know, Heather touched on it, too. I should have mentioned, you know, there was the reason Solis recorded everyone is because the FBI had been recording him and there was all this evidence against him. He did this to so because he didn't want to go to prison, right? And so
he wanted to keep his pension.
He wanted to keep his pension. So we're going to hear about all the stuff that he says that Madigan did, but the defense is also going to point out all of the evidence that had been gathered against Solis, the bribes he had been taking, the campaign cash, the prostitution, the Viagra. And they need jurors to understand that he's not just here just to save his own skin, that he's telling the truth. That's part of his deal. And I expect he's going to be corroborated by the recordings. And that's what the government wants to carry the day. But
yes,
it's important.
Well, it sounds like Monday's going to be
he was very calm during the Burke trial because Burke's lawyers called him as essentially a defense witness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Solis over and over again did not take the bait that Burke's lawyers sort of dangled in front of him, trying to get him engaged about what he did and how worried he was about going to prison and that sort of thing. So if he, you know, replicates that sort of approach, you know, we've already had a federal jury sort of find him credible, which has got to keep Madigan and his attorneys up at night.
Listen, so much more that we could dig into here with John, but that is Chicago Sun-Times course reporter John Seidel. We appreciate the update.
Of course.
Now, turning to another story on our radar, I mean, even though it's more than 2 years away, there's already a push, Heather, to get one Illinois politician to run for mayor of Chicago in 2027. Huh?
So the election is over. The election has begun. That is how it all
works. We just love elections.
Yeah. So everybody is looking ahead. And so the next mayoral and aldermanic elections are in 2027. And I think that, you know, I don't think even the mayor would disagree. He has had a bumpy year and a half in office, and politicians are an ambitious bunch, so they are always looking to see what office is going to open, how can I run. 2027 is a long way away.
And let me point out, Secretary of State Janulius would still be up for re-election in 2026 for his current role.
Right.
I mean, so even if he is interested in becoming mayor, how would that even shake out?
It's anybody's guess. And there are sort of bigger political questions, I think, at hand. How will Chicago fare during the second Trump administration's first years? What will U.S. Senator Dick Durbin do? Everybody expects him widely not to run for another six-year term.
That's right.
He is, you know, in his 80s. And I think if he does not run again, that is going to set off a scramble for his seat. And I think that sort of how that shakes out will sort of determine sort of what happens in the mayoral race. Now, every mayoral election, there are going to be two dozen people who actually file to run, and there will be dozens and dozens more who consider running because people look at, you know, Brandon Johnson and Lori Lightfoot, and they say, well, if they got elected mayor, maybe I could be elected mayor too, and hope springs eternal. Will I personally be writing any speculative pieces about who's going to run for mayor in 2027?
No.
No, I will not.
You will not. I mean, Brandon, we just wrapped up a national election. The last Chicago mayoral one, it doesn't feel like it was that long ago. I don't know. Maybe this is just like news fatigue talking here, but is it normal that we're already planning for 2027?
I would say it is normal in the sense that, like, shout out to Marianne Ahern for bringing this conversation to the forefront, because it's actually been happening for months. Like, I've been hearing the speculation, and they've been talking in their little rooms and tapping on Rush and all this about, oh, maybe this guy. Maybe we can kick in for this guy. And it's always going to happen.
Yeah.
This is always going to happen, whether the mayor is unpopular or not. Who's up next, right? And so it's the usual cast of suspects, right? It's people we've heard before in past cycles, people that we know are going to probably run again, like a Willie Wilson. Like,
oh my gosh. I forgot about that.
It's people like a Jamal Green.
I remember that free gas, though.
Many people do, you know? So I say we can't put a lot of weight into this early talk. It's all talk at this point.
All right. So, Patrick, before we take a break here, another story on our radar. Hospitals in Chicago, they've been investing less and less in midwifery. And this week, one local hospital abruptly cut ties with their midwives altogether. So just catch us up on what's going on at West Suburban Medical Center in Oak Park.
Yeah. So West Suburban Medical Center in Oak Park, they just announced they're going to end. They're not going to allow midwives and family medicine physicians to deliver babies at the hospital that it's going to take effect next week. Mm-hmm. This super abrupt severing of ties with a popular group of providers that have been working there for years. And, you know, I think you mentioned at the top of the show, research shows that midwives tend to have low C-section rates and better outcomes for both parent and child. But this hospital is part of a trend, actually, of hospitals that are ending or not embracing, you know, midwives or sort of alternatives.
A lot of pregnant people rely on midwives. I mean, myself included, I used midwives for both of my pregnancies. I mean, who is most impacted here by this move?
It's women of color, pregnant people of color. They are not served well by our current, medical system. There's higher rates of complications and death in birth. And there's research that shows that midwives can help that. And particularly, this hospital in Oak Park was a place that people would come that served a lot of women of color.
Yeah.
And they're going to be affected by this. And I should say quickly, everything I'm saying is from our reporter, Kristen Schorsch, who covered this story.
For the last part of today's show, I wanted to jazz things up a bit. So I started by looking ahead to next Thursday and Thanksgiving. We're all just keeping our eye on that light in the distance, for sure. So I asked our guests their Thanksgiving hot takes. Yesterday on the show, we tried some Thanksgiving pie.
I change up the crust, and I use a buckwheat short crust to give it a little interesting flavor. And then I add some candied pepitas and buckwheat kernels on top, because pumpkin pie is so smooth, you want a little crunch.
And so I wonder, what is your Thanksgiving dessert or pie hot take? What's the best?
Pecan is the best. That's my favorite.
Oh, wow.
That is my favorite.
Patrick.
I didn't know, until three seconds ago. I didn't think that was a hot take. I didn't know that. Although, I want to say, I don't want to be, I feel like weird being the fat guy being like, all pie is good. Like, all pie is good. Like, pumpkin and apple aren't my absolute favorite, but they're good. Like, who are we kidding here?
That old debate of sweet potato versus pumpkin pie. Brandon, where do you fall?
Well, I'm a sweet potato guy usually. I think pumpkin's fine. This little poll that went out there to the state of Illinois, I'm so confused. Did they talk to any black people?
You've got a problem with the map?
I don't think any black people were interviewed, because they would have all said sweet potato, right? Like, I'm shocked.
Well, I don't bake, so shout out to my husband, who every Thanksgiving makes a pumpkin cheesecake.
Oh, yes.
I really think sort of, you know, splits the difference between you want a little bit of pumpkin sort of in your Thanksgiving life, but it's cheesecake, so it's ultimately better.
See, that I can do.
Pumpkin cheesecake. All right, this isn't a hot take. This is a confession, and this is really a two Americas moment. I don't know if I've ever had sweet potato pie.
Whoa.
I mean it.
Wow.
I'm going to fix that.
Okay. Yeah. Good. That's not good. That's kind of why I'm saying this. Like, people, bring me sweet potato pies.
You can have listeners ship sweet potato pies to WBEZ now.
You know, I have never had vanilla ice cream with cookie dough on top.
Oh,
if somebody could say
really?
I've never had it.
Cherry cheesecake. I've never tasted that either.
Wow.
If someone could just send me, please, you know, just a slice. So yesterday we talked pies on the show, and then the week prior, we talked savory foods on the Thanksgiving table. So I want you to listen to what this guest is talking about here. This is an interesting way that he says his family makes the turkey.
My dad, a medical professional in the 90s, felt turkey was dry, felt turkey needed spice because he's Pakistani and they like spice. He brought syringes home from the hospital, clean ones, of course, and made a little like buffalo sauce kind of thing and injected under the skin and in the meat. I think our hot sauce injected turkey is pretty good and flexible.
That's Ahmed Ali Akbar from the Chicago Tribune. I saw lots of faces around the table when you heard about that hot sauce injected turkey.
Mm-hmm.
Who's willing to try it?
Absolutely. Me. I need that recipe.
Yeah, it sounds amazing.
Yeah.
Sure. If I have a Thanksgiving hot take, it's that turkey is overrated and that...
So overrated.
You do not need turkey to have like a well-rounded Thanksgiving meal. I think that Thanksgiving is all about side dishes. You want a little bit of this and a little bit more of that and not all that together. So if you're doing anything to like re-envision the bland turkey, I say Godspeed.
No, that's got the smallest portion by far on my plate is the turkey. I don't care how good you are. Your turkey's dry.
I mean, a really good turkey.
Turkey's good.
I got to defend my mom here. I deep fry a turkey every year at our place.
Oh, okay.
And that turns out pretty well.
Fire department, just be on standby.
It's a hazard because you know who's deep frying it. It's the big guy. Yeah.
Patrick out here representing the turkey is good crew.
It is good.
It can be good.
Sure.
I don't think it's inherently good.
I mean, I guess.
Be. You can doctor it up. Yeah. Need a lot of doctoring.
Yeah, I'm really like against you today. Like,
yeah.
So you're saying turkey's good. You've never had sweet potato pie. Like,
I like pecan pie.
A lot of tension in
what
this
else is horrible right now about your eating habits?
I mean, maybe, probably everything. I don't know.
Boy. Anyway, what goes with Thanksgiving better than some good old American football?
Yeah.
So while we're on the topic, I want to talk about the Bears because I know
they have
womp, womp.
Wow. Wow, but they're playing. They've got a Thanksgiving morning game, right?
My advice to everybody on Thanksgiving is enjoy your time with your family. Don't watch that Bears game. There's no use.
The Bears are playing the Detroit Lions.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I am a Lions fan. And
okay.
Congratulations.
I'm almost as strongly an anti-Bears fan, so this season has been delicious. I've got to admit, though, I'm nervous. The Lions don't handle mobile quarterbacks very well. I feel like the Bears are going to wake up at some point, but I hope they just kind of keep being a laughing stock. That's fun too.
I guarantee the Lions will win this game.
It to the bank.
I'll take it to the bank. The Bears have to play the Vikings this Sunday, go to the Lions, Niners, Vikings, close up the Lions again, the Seahawks, and Green Bay. They're not they could lose all of those games.
Heather, can we get some positivity from you for our home team?
So I grew up a massive Bears fan. I could perform the Super Bowl shuffle for you here now. I will not.
Okay.
But it's
for our YouTube audience, yeah, please.
Yeah. It's painful, right? And I think it comes at a very bad time for the team politically because they want literally billions of dollars in subsidy from the state for a new stadium. Yeah. And that is a harder ask when you are just literally giving it away on the last play of games.
Yeah.
It just is.
Speaking of that, I mean, the Bears are pushing for a new stadium outside of Soldier Field. So are the Chicago Fire, right? This week, the Fire are closing in on a short list of site options for their own soccer stadium. Now, I mentioned this on the show earlier in the week with Danny Ecker from Crane's Chicago Business. But I do want to hear your take. I mean, what is wrong with the stadiums that we have right now? And why does everybody want a new one? Can someone clear that up for me?
You got to go stadium by stadium.
Okay.
I can't do that here. But I'll just say, I get the Soldier Field stuff. Soldier Field is the worst NFL stadium in the NFL. So I understand
which taxpayers are still paying for,
by the
way.
And that's part of the issue, too. But there's no home field advantage. There's no roof. That's the move nowadays. I get the angst there. The problem is they're trying to get us to pay all this money for a new one.
Yeah. That's where it gets a little weird.
Yeah.
I do think like for them and the White Sox, there should be a rule like you can't suck and ask for a bunch of money. Like, you have to do one or the other.
I think that would pass unanimously.
I think it would.
It's part of that. Like, okay, yeah, maybe Soldier Field isn't the best, but like you guys decided a while ago that you wanted to put this new spaceship on top and have taxpayers pay for it. We're still doing that. You don't get a do-over.
New spaceship. Okay, so while we're getting in the holiday swing of things, the CTA holiday train and bus are back. Yay.
So wholesome.
Yes. It starts next Friday.
I've never rode it.
Oh, my goodness.
What?
Yeah. Wow. Me neither. I've always wanted to.
I did last year, and it was so much fun. It's gorgeous. I love it. So for the 33rd year, next Friday, the CTA is answering the question, what would a Christmas tree look like if it were a train instead? Of course, the Metra holiday train is also back at the end of the month. So are you Team Metra or Team CTA when it comes to the holiday trains?
Oh, I didn't even know Metra had a holiday train.
Me neither. So by default, CTA, right?
Yeah.
Well, Lisa Labas is a big advocate for the bus. You got to get on the holiday bus,
okay.
She says.
That's
worth
it. Does Santa ride on top of the bus like he does on the CTA train?
Yeah, Lisa has.
No, Lisa says Santa is in the bus.
Okay. That's jovial. Wow.
That's great.
Love that.
Yeah, none of us have been on the bus, so we're going to move right along. So we can't end the week without giving an honorable mention to a story that was just pure Chicago joy. So the Jeremy Allen White lookalike contest. Did you all see that?
Yeah, that was wild.
That was pretty cool. I saw this one, I mean, over in Humboldt Park, out of a sea of Chicagoans that were all wearing white T-shirts and blue aprons, 37-year-old Glenview therapist Ben Shabbat was crowned the winner. Did you see him? I mean, yeah. I think he really does look like Carmi.
He is the spitting image of Carmi, absolutely. Yeah.
Are you Bear fans?
Love the Bear. Yeah. Great show. Yeah. I just plead with us as Chicagoans to stop copying New York on everything.
Yes.
Ooh.
Yes.
We,
say more.
We wouldn't do this if they didn't have the Timothy Chalamet lookalike contest in New York.
We need to do our own thing,
let's be
friends.
Original. Yeah, yeah. Come on.
Yeah.
So do we have another hour?
Did a bunch of, like, skinny, sickly boys show up to that?
And Timothy Chalamet showed up.
Oh, okay. So one more skinny, sickly looking boy.
Wait, Heather is...
I have mixed feelings about the Bear. It is in some ways very Chicago, and I love that. But it's also sort of the type of show that refers to Kim Fox as the Cook County District Attorney, which drives me absolutely. So they're just the first season I thought really sort of embodied the sort of Chicago like grit vibe.
Yeah.
I think also that we have just this huge second city chip on our shoulder that, like, anything about Chicago has to be, like, defining of Chicago and everybody has to love it. But on some hand, it's a little bit made by people who say they're from Chicago but actually grew up in Naperville. So, you know.
Shots fired.
Shout out to Ben Chabon. Congratulations on the win.
We all know Heather never going to hold back. I respect
Lisa Lava says, my favorite thing about this winner is that he's a therapist. Carmi needs a therapist.
Oh, yeah.
Gosh, yes.
Really, the character in the show.
All of the therapy.
Did anyone see the baby, Alan White?
Oh, of course.
Oh, I did not. No, yes. It sounds adorable.
2-year-old Massimo Morelli was a finalist. Now, if you're looking for a dopamine boost, apparently he's got an Instagram, and the handle is @thebabychef. Finally.
Oh, boy. Let me look up.
All right. We'll leave it there. Our thanks to Brandon Pope of CW26, Heather Sharon from WTTW, and WBEZ's Patrick Smith.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Maha Ahmed and Linnea Dominic. It was edited by Dan Tucker and mixed by Ari Mejia, with additional support from Ethan Schwab. Every Friday, we bring you a roundup of the important news happening in Chicago and beyond. Make sure to subscribe to this podcast so that you never miss new episodes. And sign up for our newsletter, will ya? Just head to wbez.org/resetnews. Thanks for listening. We'll talk again tomorrow.
My name is Liz, and as a teacher, I think that WBEZ provides endless sources that I can bring back to my students where they can also engage in a deeper understanding. I teach government, I teach U.S. history, and I have used sources from WBEZ in order to help enrich the understanding of my students.